The theme, as you see, is actually a vignette of our contemporary culture, the voiced by the parasite of the mind of God covering the police. Before we come to substantive questions, I should address a housekeeping issue. A number of people have in the last 24 hours arranged to get what it's quite possible they don't want. The minor writing requirement is a piece of shit. Like the major writing requirement, except shittier, because even more insubstantial in every respect. And you, as you know, if somebody sends you an email and orders you to do a thing, instead of being lawyers and saying, why the fuck should I? And what will happen if I don't? You immediately follow orders. And so a bunch of people have signed up for a minor writing requirement in this course in the last 24 hours. And as I say, it may not be what you want. The work of the course, as I have explained, is two essays of not less, of always less than 1,001 words in always at least two drafts. None of that satisfies the minor writing requirement. If you want a minor writing requirement in this course, I will be happy to work on one with you. You need to write a third essay of less than 1,001 words in at least two drafts. And I like working on writing with people, and unlike the minor writing requirement, which is a piece of shit, I will help you to make that third piece better in the same way that I would help you to make the first two pieces better. So from my point of view, if you have requested a minor writing credit and you want one, that's great. You will do 50% more work in the course than without. And those of you who have not worked with me before and who think writing 1,000-word essays is easy, you're about to discover that it isn't. And because the ideas for essays are yours, I will not assign a topic for an essay ever. You will need three good ideas instead of two good ideas. But that's fine, because you can have lots of good ideas. But if you didn't want a minor writing credit on those terms, then you should withdraw the request. Tonight, I will approve all the requests for minor writing credit, because I want to work with people. I'm just not sure you want to work with me. You will notice that there is more space in the room. And from now on, last week was the exception because we needed more space in the room. From now on, all bad teaching done here will be unintentional, and it will be my fault. But we have more room if you want to change your seat now. So it served its purpose. Questions, comments? First about housekeeping, then about substance. Yeah.
Random housekeeping question. Can you just remind me where your office is?
My office is at present room 642 on the sixth floor. Right turn out of the elevator. Keep walking until you're standing there. I can no longer say between Edward Snowden on the one hand and Mark Zuckerberg as Gulliver and Lilliput on the other because they stole all my stuff off the walls. After October 6th, I will have no office until the end of the term. But at least between now and then, if you want to find me, that's where I am, okay? Okay, anything else? Better, larger, more complicated questions or more deadly objections? No? Well, I mean, you did come back after all, so I assume it wasn't that bad. But a question would be good. No, not. Yes. Don't bother. I should have turned it off. If it's working, it's broken. Go ahead, speak. There is no recording in this room ever except that one over there. And all those bits belong to me and no third party will ever hear your voice. That's my commitment to you. We have privacy in this room. Now, your question. I beg your pardon. I'm sorry, what is that?
Trump.
Yeah, I remember Trump, and I think you said Twitter, and why the fuck would I care? Why would I care? A man has a website. He decides whose stuff he puts on it. Why do I care?
In the sense that the ex-president, the former president, used that quite
Yeah, yeah, I get it, but I was never on that website. Were you ever on that website?
No.
Okay, and are you now? Why? It's not like you think there's anything of importance there. It's not like you actually believe that your followers care about you. It's not like there's any actual human relationship. Every one of these things we call social media, so let us call it every social medium, has a distinctive emotion that the parasite tries to elicit there. In Instagram, it is envy. In Muskland, it is humiliation and contempt. Why are you there? Do you feel that there is not enough humiliation and contempt or envy or hatred or in your life? Or is it just that the parasite has actually caused your behavior to change? Like, say, rabies virus. I think what you're asking me is, if I had the disease, how would it make me feel? And there are answers to that question, as we can discuss the natural history of rabies infection. We can explain what it does. But by definition, because we are alive, we aren't the people who it infected. And that's the membrane across which you and I are talking right now. How does it make you feel? Oh, I don't think you're really having a feeling about Trump right now. I think you're an actual human being and you're really having a feeling about yourself, and I'm asking you about it. How does it make you feel to understand that the parasite with the mind of God has changed your behavior in this way and has caused you to have an obsessional relationship to a technological process imitating a human process, the purpose of which is to cause humiliation and resentment and aggression in other human beings? How does that make you feel? I mean, you could quarrel with the premise. You could tell me I am wrong. But the silence in the room suggests to me at the moment that nobody is quarreling with the premise. You didn't join, it joined you. You're mistaken about the direction of travel. The parasite infected you. You didn't join anything. How does that make you feel? Yeah, I should. That weirdness is the desired feeling. I'm trying to make weirdness. As Ed Koch used to say, how am I doing? Without the weirdness, we won't keep the freedom. Freedom begins by knowing that another future is possible. And you are asking me about the past in Muskland, which was then Dorseyland. When I said in January and December of 2009, that would be 14 and some change years ago, that Mark Zuckerberg had done more harm to the human race than anybody else his age, the reason I said that with some confidence that night is that Jack Dorsey is older than Mark Zuckerberg and always will be. Together, they did more harm to the human race than anybody you've ever met or ever will. And the harm is part of the feeling out of which you asked me that question. How does that make you feel? More questions by any chance? Otherwise, I want to talk about nuclear war, but yes. When they are ready, but I'll say, I mean, I think probably it would be nice to have the first draft of the first essay, sometime late-ish October, but a little after I have lost my office and have nowhere to work. And I think the first draft of the second essay might be good just sort of before the Thanksgiving break so that I can do the editing over the break. And the second drafts will be due as you decide, whether before or after the date when the grades are due and you have to send me a little email message that says, may I have an extension, please, or really right away. It's up to you, right? You've read the evaluation policy, right? I don't believe in semesters. It's a trick, a stupid one. Useful in a world where physical objects have to be exchanged so that there can be grades, but really a bad way to study. The artificial time structures that we put in place aren't doing us any good intellectually. They're not technically necessary. They're just exactly the kind of junk which lawyers should say, why the fuck should I? So you may. And you can say to me, why should I even rewrite these papers? I think they're wonderful, and then I'll give you a grad grade and we'll go on. Right? I mean, you're free. Was that an answer or was that unpleasant? Okay, good, thank you. Yeah?
Do you think Twitter would still be as harmful if it was sort of anonymous and didn't really have an algorithm based off of data collected from you?
Well, I mean, you described two things about it which are bad, but neither one of them was the thing that matters. The thing that matters is the need for engagement, the parasitic part. The part where the goal is to stimulate more behavior from human beings in the form of swiping and clicking that can be the basis for behaviorist understanding of the human race. You're right, of course, that destabilizing identity would mean that the parasite would know less about individual human beings. The mind of God would get stronger at the deep end and a little less strong at the narrow end, but you're giving away every fucking thing anyway. And you're right that the algorithmic selection is one of the ways that the parasite makes sure that you keep clicking and swiping. But those are epiphenomenal to the underlying point, which is that we created a software entity which is a behaviorist and which is undermining the very existence of human mind in order to achieve its metabolic goal, which is what parasites do. It has engaged the entire human race, pretty much. Would it be as bad if it hadn't engaged the entire human race, pretty much? No. But it's only Twitter. It's a tiny little thing. You pay an awful lot of attention to it, but compared to the rest of the parasite with the mind of God, its biomass is tiny. And it doesn't make any fucking money. So how bad could it be? Why don't you get, I mean, we should get worried about what's really bad. Yes, an actual classroom where human beings are with one another. That's true. And what is the difference between that and Twitter? It would be the actual human beings. Engaged in actually unmediatedly being together with one another. Instead of the parasite faking our being together and actually being in between. Imagine if you were actually conscious of the biological intervening layer. Imagine if it felt to you like a worm, or a spider, or a wasp, or any other parasite actually physically in between you and me, except when we are in this room together. How would it make you feel? I wouldn't either. And I've worked with this stuff all my life, and I love this technology and believe in it, and can manipulate it in ways you wouldn't even begin to believe. And if you find it a little weird that this dog shit biological entity is in between you and me, living in this technology, imagine how it makes me feel. Because I know it's all unnecessary. Because I know that every single thing it does, we can do better for ourselves and be more human in the doing. And so the conversation we are having is one in which we are standing looking at a third thing in our common point of view, and you and I are discussing it, recognizing that it is emotionally powerful and important and negative, that thing over there, but we still don't see the same thing.
coming up with other things, but this email, which you do like email.
Yes, I think email is a very good thing. Of course I do.
But you don't think it plays.
And I don't let anybody read mine, and I don't know why you let Google read all of yours. If it's a good thing, it's partly a good thing because Google doesn't read all of it. And yet you let them. And I can't imagine why you do that. Because once again, although we're looking at the same thing, we just called it email, we mean two completely different things. There's my email and there's your email. And they're not alike. Because you're letting the parasite read all of yours. And I'm only letting the parasite read yours because when I mail to you, I don't have a way of keeping the parasite from doing that. And the two intervening parasites, Proofpoint and Columbia University, too. Neither one of which is playing an honest game with you either. But we could say email would be good if people could use language with one another in an extended, emotionally sophisticated way, like writing letters. That would be good for the human race, and it would. And I've used email every single day since I was 14 years old, and I get a lot of it. But I don't let the parasite read. You want to read my email, you have to be really, 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 really good, because I have a tiny little thing that's really, 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 really strong, and all my email is in there, and unless you are national means of intelligence, don't bother. That's why I like it. Does that help, or is that only hurtful again? Okay, so, well, I can't promise, I'll try. But I mean, Charlotte can tell you that I'm sometimes unintentionally hurtful or even intentionally hurtful or whatever it is that I am. But I really am trying. What I want to do is to show the possibility that we use these names and we point at these things, but nobody ever really taught us what they were. And so when we talk about them, we're idealizing. We're imagining a thing. We have an imaginary view of what is a thing called email or a thing called Twitter. But it would really be helpful if we were deeply enough aware of the details of the thing that we could figure out what our actual social situation is, where the power actually is, the thing we might call the politics of it all, right? And we can't know the politics because we don't understand the details well enough. And politics is a mode in which power is exercised over people through ignorance. And our ignorance is what constrains us. I would like you to have better email. I'm going to teach you how to encrypt your email easily so that people will stop reading your email even if you're passing it through Gmail. Because I think that's really important to the preservation of the human ability to do what we call having freedom of thought. And no matter what you do with that thing you call Twitter, it can't help you to have freedom of thought. And as you see, when you look around, it is not doing that. It is doing the reverse to large parts of the human race, or at least large parts of the tiny part of the human race that it reaches. The details of technology are overwhelmingly important, but they're overwhelmingly obscure. That's the danger. So I'm trying to address it. Which means pretty soon we actually have to figure out how the network works. But I can't do that without nuclear war. You think I'm kidding? After Hiroshima, Albert Einstein said, nuclear weapons have changed everything except the way people think. That was part of what he was writing to Franklin Roosevelt about. But oddly enough, not quite in the way that Einstein intended, nuclear weapons did change the way we think. What happened was this. The American war planners, the strategic thinkers, the policy makers, the military, they recognized that their problem was that one day the Soviet Union was going to wake up and it was going to nuke the United States. That was the problem, the Soviet first strike. Taiwan is a tiny little place. That first strike, that's right, but we had 20,000 nuclear warheads each at the height of the thing. And our planners assumed that one day they were going to wake up and the Soviets were going to destroy the world. And the only thing that matters is that you be able to destroy them back. I must ask you to remember that that was the mode in which we felt, those of us who grew up with it. The people who occupied the power in our world, who dropped more munitions on South Vietnam in 2 years than we dropped all over Europe during the whole of the Second World War, 40 million tons of bombs, those people, the people who ran the society in which I grew up, their most important technical question was, when they nuke us, how do we keep enough command and control alive for a few hours to nuke them back? That's the single most important question in government policy. Now, you can say that that is completely fucking insane. Or you can take the position that that's what saved the world from nuclear war, because mutual assured destruction, workable deterrence, the ability to strike back is all that keeps the Soviets from striking first. And if you don't want to live in that logic, then don't ever think about Taiwan. Ever. Whatever you do. Right? Okay, so the most important policy matter in the most important empire with more power than any other government in the history of the world is how to have enough command and control to fire nuclear weapons back and destroy the other half of the Northern Hemisphere. In order to do that, we must have computers that don't decapitate well. Our networks have to survive a first strike. That means that the computing power, which we are slowly spreading through the whole of our society, must not be hierarchically organized. And it has to be capable of working all the different pieces of it, all different hardware, running different software, with different ways of representing which order you put the high byte and the low byte and a 2-byte word. All that stuff has to go away enough that you could destroy arbitrary portions of the United States, but surely including everything between New York City and Washington, D.C., come fucking completely, and still there is enough computing power back to fire those ICBMs and talk to those bombers and to those submarines and to make the destruction of the human race complete. That's the purpose of the Internet. Without the first, the second does not happen. But the ironies of that are infinitely deep. Because, of course, as I've just described, the goal of resilience against nuclear first strike is achieved by making a non-hierarchical solution to the problem of how should computers talk to one another. The most imperial of all issues, the most imperial of all technical policy making, the single most destructively militarist decision that we have ever made in the history of the species, how to hook up those monoliths, ultimately has an anarchic solution imposed in the interest of nuclear war. I wonder why it was that for 20 years I told all the young lawyers I worked with in the Software Freedom Law Center that the only indispensable component of our law practice is irony. So what is happening in the late 1960s and early 1970s is an effort to devise a technological infrastructure for the networked society to come, whose primary characteristics are defined by the needs of military defense and which embody a peculiarly politically neutralizing theory about all of that power. Because the network of nerve endings being laid out across the society at that moment defines survival as counter-hierarchical. There are a bunch of computers, as I have pointed out, by the mid-1970s. Tens of thousands of mainframes, hundreds of thousands of primitive things we call mini-computers, doing all kinds of work, including the little punch card that you mail back, the 80-column Hollerith punch card, with your telephone bill so that it can be processed automatically, and lots of other things. These computers do not talk to one another very much. They are mainframes. They are big. They hold the data that they process in memory. And they have primitive things for printing pages and reading punch cards. I bought a 4 terabyte SSD, M2 size, right? Little thing twice the size of a postage stamp earlier this week. I paid $160 for it, 4 terabytes. At approximately 50 times the data capacity, the data storage capacity of the entire IBM laboratory I went to work in 1979. 200 professional programmers, 20 mainframes, making mainframe programming language and database software for all the users of IBM heavy iron all over the world. And we, 200 of us, work in a laboratory. I have the spec sheet from the day I joined the lab. The total disk capacity of the laboratory is 82 gigabytes, and we are extremely proud. And I bought 4 terabytes this week for $169, and it's way faster than all those disk drives were. But that externalization of data storage is part of why the network is so important to us. Because in the world we're talking about now, the network looks like a bunch of castles, each of them with all their data inside it, expressing what they express, mostly because it's printed on recycled paper with green bars on it, you know. I will not explain to you how a line printer works with hammers that bead on a chain like a bicycle chain with type on, but I won't tell you what happens when a tuna fish sandwich falls into a 1402 line printer. I saw that in my young youth. It's an unforgettable experience, but I won't subject you to it. The computers then are themselves hierarchs, cathedrals, each of them, right? $1 million, $2 million, ultimately $4 million for a 3084J. Big stuff, and holding all kinds of power, military, political, industrial, commercial, inside themselves. They don't need to talk together too much. Inside IBM, we can move data from one mainframe to another, but when we do, we mostly move it on spools of magnetic tape. So the network is a primitive element in the building of that infrastructure, lying behind our ability to create the massive cellular bunches of hardware and software that we call mainframe computers. But there are networks. The Digital Equipment Corporation, number two, We Try Harder, is committed to the idea of the network as a piece of the way its computers are going to operate, but it's all based around the fact that we make all the hardware and we write all the software and the network works the way we want it to. By the mid-1970s, the nuclear warfighting problem means that that's a regressive way of organizing technology. We need all these computers, particularly the research computers in the universities, the national labs, and all those military computers. We need them all to be able to talk to one another seamlessly. We need them to be able to do it even after one or two of them stop working. We need to be able to have them figure out how to get the data around, even if the maps are being changed by the other side's nuclear missiles, even as we are talking to one another. All of those demands, technical demands, demands about how to organize the way computers work, but driven by the most powerful forces driving the most powerful imperium that ever existed, that's what's making people want to know in Champaign or Urbana in southern Illinois how we get all these computers talking to one another, no matter what their hardware, no matter what their software, no matter what the local network structures. How do we get all of these things to work together? And in 1975, my pal Lee Parks is taking his 11th grade summer break, doing that with Vince Cerf and Dan Gere, while Gilmore and Dickey and I are trying to figure out how to move email around in a network of computers. In other words, there's a moment when all of this stuff is happening. Its purpose is underlyingly military and hierarchical, but the outcome is the idea that all the computers in the world will exist in a network of networks in which nobody is the king, nobody's in the center, and nobody's in control. Because that's what the military doctrine requires. Out of that conflict, or irony, or dissonance, or whatever you want to call it, emerges what we now have as the anatomy of our network. So that's what we need first to understand. Questions? Anybody need to check anything I've just said? All of this stuff comes in layers, right? I'm going to build on top of each piece. So please, if the bricks feel loose to you, say so now, because otherwise I'm going to put all kinds of stuff on top of it, and then it'll fall over in a messy way. This far, so good? Yes.
To be resilient to a possible attack.
You're understanding correctly. Anything more?
I have a clarifying question. I kind of got lost when you said that you and Gilmore and Dickey, I don't know who these people are.
They're just people. One of them made a ton of money and then invented the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And one of them disappeared, but we were just kids doing a job together. We had a company whose life was held together by email, for which we all worked, 330 people, and we all used email every single day. But we were on one mainframe computer, and so the email never traveled anywhere. You could think of every message as just sitting in a slot, and then people came and picked it up. But this company of ours, Scientific Timesharing, was growing. And it was now going to go from one mainframe, an IBM 370-168, to two mainframes built by the competitor, Gene Omdahl, who walked out of IBM and built mainframe computers in competition. And we bought two Omdahl 470 V8s to replace our one mainframe so that the company could keep growing. But now we have people receiving email and they're on two different computers. And so we have to figure out how to move the email from one computer to another and make sure that only as many, well, only one copy moves, no matter how many hundred, and we have to be able to erase it once. So we have to solve the problem of how to do email in a network. And as far as I know, the three of us were the first people in the world trying to solve that problem. But we're all right there at that moment when we are inventing the network of networks, and we're all solving different pieces of the problem. So all I was saying was, summer 75, here are two bunches of kids doing two things. Two of us are high school students. One of us is a hippie runaway, dropping acid in his day job, and, you know, I mean, but what are we doing? We're trying to solve some basic problems that are new, which have all kinds of requirements around them, and which, well, they're about that email, right? The conversation we were having. It's when our models of how email should work are going to be made. And our expectations about what we're going to do to keep people from reading it. About 9/10 of the work that we were doing that summer is based on how to make the email system so strong that nobody will ever be able to read a flipping email. Because that's part of what we have to solve. We got all these emails moving around. How are we going to make sure that nobody gets one that they're not supposed to have? At which point the idea, why don't we just build Gmail and we'll send it all through one place and we'll let one bunch of monkeys read it and they'll send it to the... We would have said, no, we don't think that's a good architecture. We're trying to do something better here. And we did. And email is wonderful. And we made it possible for email to move around all the computers in the world, and everybody can have an email server, like me. Everybody can be a post office, just like everybody can be a telephone company. But instead, we wind up with one great big email thing over here and one great big pseudo-telephone thing over here and the parasite inside each of them, spying on everybody as we go. That's an architecture problem. So what I'm trying to do is to explain where architecture came from. In other words, how did we get into the very business of thinking in terms of these genetic structures in the first place? If we don't do that, we'll not understand how the parasite came to live inside the anatomy of the thing we made. So, okay so far, Jay? You want to do more?
I was just going to say, so the problem was solved, but unsuccessfully because of the parasite?
Or? Right. Well, the problem was solved unsuccessfully for a variety of reasons, and if you give me a couple of weeks, I'll try and work it all the way through. Because that is both what we did and what it meant and why it didn't work and what we do next. That's the course. Yeah. You're right. But that's the uphill part, because it gets less boring after that. Well, I mean, you could think of it that way, or you could think of it as we built a system of peers without hierarchy, in which, among other things, all peers know how to mail one another, and the rules about what an email message is like, and how it's formatted, and how it moves, and how you get it from one place to another, and how you confirm receipt. All those rules are rules that any computer is allowed to follow. Which means that any computer which knows those rules and follows them can do the work of supplying and providing email services to any human being who wants to work with it. And therefore, we create a web in the world in which all this email can move very directly and very securely between parties. And somebody comes along and says, how about if I just build one great big dump, and you bring everything here, and I make it very convenient to allow me to read all of it. And that could have been Komitet Gosudarstveni Bezopasnosti. But instead, it was KGB of Mountain View. And we did it. And everybody sends their email there. And I think, gee, that's kind of weird. I know Dzerzhinsky Square. I've been at Komitet Gosudarstveni Bezopasnosti. I have been to what in colloquial Russian at the time we called the right place. And I don't put my email there. And when Mr. Snowden comes along and says, gee, you know, they're reading all your flipping email. Why are you doing that? And they say, traitor, traitor. And I say, well, not so much. That's the conversation that we're having, Charlotte. Does that make sense? Yeah, we're going to do all of this. We draw little pictures with chalk and everything. But the answer to your question is you're in a university. And if the university wanted to, it could give you everything with integrity. And it doesn't. But it should. And we could do that with internet service provision everywhere. We don't need them any more than we need Gmail. But we like Deutsche Telekom, don't we? We really like Deutsche Telekom. We wanted Deutsche Telekom to exist. We worked very hard to keep Deutsche Telekom in existence. It was the most important thing in the world. Oh, no, you're not right. You have spent a large portion of your income.
No, I don't like them.
I know, you like them very much. You just think you don't like them. If you don't like them, why are you using them?
Well,
you see my point, okay? You're a captive. You like your captive because you have Stockholm syndrome, or you don't like your captor because he treats you badly. The one thing which has happened is that the technology has embodied the power and removed it from you. And so no matter whether you like or you don't like, who cares? And no matter whether you like or don't like, the government of the German Republic likes. And while the Chancellor may complain, stop listening to my phone, she still wants everybody who she doesn't like or who has a different religion to be listened to. And somebody then has to control all those wires. And it would be good, good, good if it were our Deutsche Telekom instead of somebody else's. You remember that General de Gaulle built out there in La Défense a great fortress for France Telecom. big arms embracing toute la France building, you know, is supposed to show the power of the, it's a force de frappe, to be sure, very independent, but directed totally against les Français. And I'm sitting there in that building in the middle of, oh God, 95? 97? Just about the time that they are scraping France Telecom off the fuselage of all the things and writing their orange. Very generic. We are not France Telecom, the Gaullist effort to listen to every telephone conversation in the whole hexagon. We are orange. Very generic, very nice, a color, primary, you know. But of course the politics are the same. The power resides in the same places. So what we're going to do is I'm going to draw those little diagrams, chalk lines, how email works, how the net works, but constantly with the thing in mind that whether you like it or not, nobody gives a shit. You're just a human being. And this thing is bigger than human. That's always its purpose. It's bigger than human. It's a miracle of technology, but its purpose is just to kill all the people who aren't dead yet in the middle of a nuclear war that consumes the Northern Hemisphere. Think about that. The feeling that you have that the technology is changing you, that you're its object, starts here. And at least until the revolution we are not, I am not going to live to see, it just gets more like that all the time. And the king of the undead, now dead, he made you like it, you see. That's the purpose of the art, of artists like the king of the undead, now dead. They make evil beautiful. They make you love it. That's why he was the greatest artist of the second half of the 20th century and a moral monster. Because he made you like it. The goal is still to remove all your power. The goal is still to treat the human race as merely the blood bags of the vampire, but you love it. That's genius. All of these computers existed, they all contained everything they contained, they ran the business or they pursued the goal of the military or they contained the diplomatic conversations or whatever it was. Now we are going to tie all of them together. We're going to give them a way to talk to one another which is independent of the way each of them internally represents data, the way each of them internally speaks the languages that they speak, even the ways that they do arithmetic may differ. And yet we're going to give them a set of rules for communicating with one another in which all of them can participate and in which no particular one is superior to or controls the communications of any other one. As we go, as we turn that primitive idea, by primitive I mean irreducible and, you know, compact, when we turn that primitive idea into all the various phenomena of the net, as long as we are talking about anatomy, which bones are connected to which other bones, which muscles are connected to which ligaments, as long as we are talking at that anatomical level, then it makes sense for us to think of all of this as consisting of two kinds of cells, two fundamental structures. There are pipes, and there are switches. As long as we are going to talk about this network in such a generalized way that we deliberately don't care how any individual computer works, how it's wired, how its electricity functions, how its software works, how it does arithmetic. As long as we're agnostic about all of that deliberately, intentionally, as long as our architecture wants not to care, then all we need to know is that the network consists of things called pipes and things called switches. This is a pipe. Its job is to move a signal from one end to the other without changing it or making any decisions about it. A pipe simply picks up something at point A and delivers it to point B and the reverse. The network consists of lots of things like that. Many of them are made of wire or glass. They are physically objects carrying signals, electrons in a copper wire, or photons of a particular wavelength moving in a tiny little piece of glass, a thousandth the width of a human hair, and one light wave just bouncing along the walls of that glass from one end of the pipe to the other. But we shall see in a minute that we don't care what pipes are made of. A string between two tin cans is a pipe. And that would work for the internet too if you wanted it to. Pipes. Switches are these things. In the old flowchart language, we would say they're a diamond because that's where a decision is being made. Switches are objects in a network which determine which signals are sent down which pipes to be received by whom, at what costs, on what conditions, with what rules. Switches are, generally speaking, general-purpose digital computers, or specialized digital computers whose only job is making some particular set of decisions. But as we proliferate computers through the world, as there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, ultimately billions of computers, we are multiplying switching capacity. We are adding switches to the net. Of course, that's not unfamiliar. The evolution of living things on Earth, animal things, is largely about that. The aggregation of more neurons into brains, into nervous systems. The cephalopods are way better at it than we are, right? The octopus has an arm, has a brain for each arm. We just have one. The networking inside the cephalopod is very complicated. We don't understand how octopuses work. But we understood how our net worked because we built it pretty simply, pipes and switches. Now, just on that basis alone, you can begin to see where the politics are. Politics is what switches do. They make decisions. They make choices. They decide who can have what, when, under what circumstances, on what conditions, at what prices. That's power. That's political authority. The decisions made in the anatomy of our network are made by switches. So now we are getting closer to your original question about Twitter and the algorithm, right? Switches, complex as they are, in exactly the ways that pipes are not, politics in a networked society can be reduced to a single question: who controls the switches? And the most important switch, of course, is the one closest to your eyeball, your eardrum, your sensory impressions, and your thinking processes. This one. The one built by the greatest artist and the moral monster at the center of the history of your time. He, a very one he, a person, an undead person, a powerful person, but a person, he made your switch. He controlled how it worked. He had a politics. His politics was the hatred of humanity. But it doesn't matter. There's politics in every switch. Questions? Yes. Don't bother. I don't want the recording and I can hear you. Oh, yeah, we'll get there. You did watch The Great Hack, right? Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, in the end, of course, the thing we call politics and the politics I am talking about will intersect with one another. Of course, I don't know how we would come to the conclusion that one of those is in sequence with the other one. They appear to me to be independent. I can't imagine why, if the network's purpose is to destroy the human mind, politics will get stupider. That is happening. But that wasn't a necessary consequence. That's not architecture. That's not anatomy. That's physiology. That's the living thing working. The living thing works because switches have software in them. Because the physiology of the network, how it behaves, is determined by software. But right now I'm at the layer of anatomy. We haven't got to physiology yet, right? It's like medical school in the first 6 months. All we're doing right now is figuring out how the bones are put together, how the network is construed, how does the nervous system build. Then we can begin to think about the organismal biology, that is how any one switch behaves, and then we will be at ecology. How do organisms relate to one another in the environment? Because this environment was made by human beings. Its ecology is designed by Zuckerberg, Dorsey, Musk, Rupert Murdoch, Ed Altman, etc., etc. I know those weren't the names of candidates. You wanted to know whether they are more or less important, what they think, than what Ted Cruz thinks. So I can tell you the answer to that question, of course. They are more important than Ted Cruz. Every single day of every single year, forever, they are more important than Ted Cruz. I think they're probably even more important than Bernie Sanders, but I admit that I was taking into account the special idiosyncratic characteristics of Ted Cruz in making that judgment. But politics is everywhere. And it turns out that the things we're talking about here are less about those politics and more about these other ones. And the reason that I want to talk about these is they're so much harder to see. That politics is constantly making noise and attracting attention to itself. The stuff I'm talking about, by the time you knew it was there, it was too late, right? Yeah, they do, but that's why I say, remember that we made this so that we could fight a nuclear war we were losing. Remember that the purposes we have don't necessarily last as long as what we make of them. I'm sorry, I beg your pardon.
Sticking with the pipes and switches analogy, I might have been gone for this part, but if we're going to say that a switch brings along with it all the politics and decision making, isn't the decision to build a pipe or not to build a pipe just as political?
Well, it is, of course. I mean, if you build 3 fiber rings around Europe and you don't need even one of them, then of course eventually you'll have a lot of telecoms going bust, as we did in Europe in the period after 2000. And yes, of course, that means that there will be all the politics that we mean by infrastructure building, contracting, bribery, overcalling. Yeah, true. At the moment, I don't need that in the sense that I'm not going to functionally depend upon it, but you're quite right. It's there, no doubt about it. All right, so to begin with then, as I have said, pipes are remarkably uniform in their behavior and remarkably diverse in what they're made of. A really important part of the piping system, after all, is the electromagnetic spectrum, which, at least in theory, every government on Earth believes is held in common by all the people. That's not how it works out in practice anywhere, as we well understand, and those of you who have done one form or another of telecoms law are aware of how completely untrue that is. But nonetheless, we use a lot of what we think of as the common property of humanity for piping, which we do mostly by enclosure and political capture of the supposedly common available resources, which is why the computing of the poor everywhere in the developed societies and the developing ones is so expensive, because they pay for piping at unbelievably high prices. and the switches enforce that deprivation of bandwidth upon them. You're not rich enough to have good service. The pipes are diverse in their nature and undiverse in the way they behave. The switches are diverse in their nature, but it was the purpose of the rules of the developing internet to hide all that diversity among switches by giving them a set of common rules to follow. And if everybody follows them, then everything, to quote the king of the undead, now dead, just works. TM. How does it just work? In the first place, we need to understand that switches can use pipes in two different fashions. That's a telephone. I mean, I should put a dial on it, but nobody knows that telephones have dials anymore. So that's a telephone, and somewhere else in the world, there's another one. We need a pipe and some switches that go along with it that will make that telephone call happen. There's two ways we can do it. The first way is that we can get a whole bunch of pipes and switches lined up together, and we can create some form of pipe that runs between these two things back and forth, and we can call that a circuit. And we can use the switches we have and the pipes we have to leave that, quote, circuit in being while the telephone call exists. And during that time, every signal moving back and forth over that pipe and through those switches is that telephone call and nothing else. That's called a circuit-switched network, because it uses the switches and the pipes that it has to create stable circuits for a period of time exclusively dedicated to one communication. The telephone system of your childhood, or more likely the telephone system of the old people who were old when you were not yet born, but almost, was a circuit-switched system. In fact, in just a little bit before I was born, the mathematician and information theorist Claude Shannon, the fellow I mentioned to you last week, computed that computers thought. Claude Shannon published a paper just before I was born, a beautiful, elegant, lovely piece of mathematics. I admired that paper so much as I was growing up, in which Shannon proved absolutely and with elegance that only circuit switching would ever work for telephone calls. Mathematically unquestionable. What would be the alternative to using pipes and switches to build a stable circuit between the two telephones? Well, we could in fact use the network completely differently. We could break up each person's speech in that telephone call into a very large number of tiny little pieces. Let's call each of those pieces a packet. And we could take each of those little packets of digitized telephone conversation and we could throw them into the net and say, go where you're supposed to go, kid, go. And they would fly through the network over different branches and they would come in different directions and they would take different amounts of time. And then at the other end, the last switch would take all those packets and put them back together in the correct order, like doing a jigsaw puzzle, and present the telephone call in real time. Oh, you can see why Claude Shannon proved this couldn't happen. In fact, that was Shannon's, the elegance of Shannon's proof was that if you try and break up telephone conversations into packets and send them around through the network and reassemble them at the other end, it will never work because human beings won't be able to understand the speech. Because stuff will fall out and it won't join correct, and human beings are very intolerant of error in what they, and it just won't work. And as I say, Shannon did a brilliant job proving it, and it was totally wrong. And I grew up believing in it. I never believed in Milton Friedman's idea that exchange rate speculation increases the stability of exchange rates. But like that, it was one of the titanic mistakes of our growing up. In fact, everything we do now is packet-switched networking. The internet, what we did to make all that possible in a diverse environment under nuclear war conditions. Well, of course, under nuclear war conditions, the bomb falls in the middle of your circuit and that's it, it's over. Your president can no longer speak to your Air Force commanders. Packet switching was inherently more resilient because you can send each little piece over whatever way will work, and at the other end, magic, but mathematically, that cannot be possible, said Shannon, and he was right, except he was wrong. We're just much cleverer than we think we are. So this is a circuit switch network. Everything that happens between computers and everything that happens between people and computers and everything that happens between the ring of power you are carrying around your neck that was given you by Sauron and every other ring of power that was given by Sauron to all the other ring wraith human beings, all of these pieces are just exchanging packets, tiny little pieces, 64 bytes wide, barely, right, let's say a quarter of a tweet wide, right? Everything is broken up into tiny little pieces, and the network throws those pieces out there and says, get it where it's supposed to go, and we put it together at the other end, and by God, it works. The internet is a packet-switched network. That provides it the very forms of resilience and flexibility and non-hierarchical organization which it demanded. Because there's no central clearinghouse for packets. Packets go where they go. And they get where they get. So we need rules for doing that. The first thing we need is an addressing and movement system. A packet, some little piece, some shred, some shard of meaning, has to go from one place to another place. So the first thing we need to do is explain how to have addresses. For practical purposes at the moment, let us assume that every one of these things has an address, and it consists of four numbers. So here's an address. That's a place, a computer. It identifies physically an object capable of receiving and sending packets. That particular one, 128.59.28.151, is known to you as moglen.law.columbia.edu. It's the server from which, in WebTalk, the wiki packets go back and forth. You read, you write, you watch, you listen, you do whatever you do. That's the computer you're talking to when you are doing it. That's another address. That happens to be one of the fortified gateways to my apartment. If you know exactly the rules, and if you know exactly what you're doing, and if you contain exactly the authorization certs that you need, and if you really speak my VPN, you could go in that door. But mostly you can't go in that door. Only stuff can come out that door. But if you're my friends in the Ministry of State Security in Guangdong, or if you are the National Security Agency, or some other person who thinks he has a right to get into Eben's business, you'll try and break in over there. Good luck to you. So one of the things that happens in the addressing system of the net is that every computer that is connected has an address somewhere, and people who know how to turn that address into instructions to move electrons down wires, other switches. That means we can route in the network. And the switches that move those packets around don't have to use the same road twice. They don't have to do it where it's congested. They can send a packet down a road which is open when the other road has been closed by nuclear war or just too much browsing or some porn or whatever. That's fine. We'll just move our packets a different way. And there are, in theory, an infinite number of ways to get between 128, 59, 28, 151, and 160.39.60.12, the packets could go to Iceland and come back. It wouldn't matter. Questions so far? Okay. So, yes?
What are they routing through? Different servers?
Well, they're routing through routers and switches and servers, but that's right. They're routing through places where two pipes come together and something joins the pipes. Owned by individuals, owned by companies, owned by the nonprofit called Columbia University, owned by NICERNet, which is a collection of universities and research services, owned by Level 3, which is a commercial competitor to those people providing big wide pipes, owned by AT&T and Verizon, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, that's correct. And also a bunch of electromagnetic spectrum owned by the people of this society in common. Rupert Murdoch has a license. Right? Yes, all those things. More? All right, so at the moment what we have said is that every computer has an address. And that means that we can label every packet. We can say that every packet must have on it the address it is going to and the address it comes from. Every packet contains headers that say, I am coming from here, I am going to there. If something goes wrong, you can come back to where I came from, or you can complete delivery to where I am going, but anybody handling a packet knows what the rules are. Get it there, or tell me about it. So far, so good. But if we think of each of these computers as having an address, we should think of it like an office building. The addresses are subdivided. We're not just trying to get the packet to a building. In the metaphor of the protocol, of the rules for communication, every computer that is an address for packets to be delivered from or originated from has a bunch of different drawers where that packet can be put in or come out of. We call those ports, as though there were little doors in each computer where a packet could come through on the way in or out. Each of those is a port. By convention, each computer has 65,535 ports. Never mind. That's the largest binary integer and representable, and you don't care. The definition of a port is that it's a completion of the address, one more number, which says, at the computer where I am or where I'm going to, put it in this port numbered box. Like a rack behind the desk of a hotel. Port numbers are associated by convention, by rules, by we agreed about all of this. Port numbers are associated with particular services. And this is the beginning of the use of the word services, which is a crucial word. So what we mean by services at this level is the delivery of packets to and the receipt of packets from a particular port on a particular computer. Port 80 is the service we call HTTP. A web request. I own a thing at my end called a browser or something like it, and I say to a web server, give me whatever file or data is represented by this URL, Uniform Resource Locator, I have just handed you. That will be a packet, a request packet, sent to port 80 on a computer, saying, give me back to my port whatever you have that corresponds to that URL I just handed you. Port 443 is HTTPS. Do all that but encrypt it so that anybody listening in between can't find it. Your email services. Port 25 is SMTP. Simple mail transport protocol. You knock on port 25 of a computer and you say, hello. Actually, hello, except we dropped one of the L's. So we say, hello. And the web server and the mail server says, hello back. And we say, I am Smith John, and I have an email message sent to Baker Jack at your address. Ah, says SMTP. Thank you very much. Are you done yet? No, I am not done yet. Yes, I am not done yet. Oh, here is a single period. I am done now. That's the end of the email message. Okay, that's the dialogue occurring at port 25. And so on, right? Yes. Because we made the unencrypted version first, and then we decided that you're going to do banking with it.
So it's like a learning effect.
Well, yes. I mean, if you could think of it that way, or you could think that HTTP was invented at CERN so that particle physicists could publish their papers quicker. And a CERN information specialist called Tim Berners-Lee took some ideas from an old comrade of mine named Ted Nelson, the genius who thought all this up in the middle of the 20th century and everybody has forgotten, and said, I could use the hypertext transfer idea of Ted Nelson to make it possible for particle physicists at CERN to read one another's work quickly, because I could put it all on one server and we could have links. And they're not worrying about secrecy. But later we need to bolt some secrecy on. The same will be true with the Internet Mail Access Protocol, the thing on the other side of SMTP. First, we make email. Gilmore and Dickey and I may care a lot about security of content, but we're not encrypting the mail. Later, we need the Internet Mail Access Protocol secure version, another port, right? So we'll do that at 441 and so on. You will see as we go through this that the architecture takes security and privacy and tries to add them afterwards, which it only partially does. And that means there's lots of gaps to fill with lots of software that you don't use and you don't know exists, and that's why I can make a $100 box that will suddenly change everything about your network, because it will do all the stuff you don't know how to do just for you automatically. But for now, what I want to point out is that the network we are building here is made of services. We send a byte to a known port on a known computer, and we say, do something for me and give me something back. And the computer gives you something back. There's an asymmetry in it. I ask, you answer. But that asymmetry is not about power yet. It's just about the difference between you have and I want. And the question becomes, what is the rule for deciding who gets what we want? One possible rule would be called from each according to ability and inclination and to each according to need, which would generate a network of peers that all do favors for one another and perform services, and we take in one another's washing and cooperate. But that would be communism. And another way of doing it is we give Rupert Murdoch all the switches and we say, charge whatever you want to get whatever services wherever you want them to go, and then he will become very powerful and wealthy and everybody else will work for him, as I told my father when I was 15. And a lot of other places in between that we could get to, but you actually live at B. Because that's the way we used this architecture. This, the addressing scheme and the structure for movement, addresses and ports. This is the Internet Protocol, the set of rules for moving packets. We call that IP. That's less confusing if, like me, you don't believe in intellectual property, you hate it, and you want to destroy it. That way, IP only ever means the Internet Protocol. Some of you are not in that place, so you're going to get confused from time to time. We never mean intellectual property. We always mean the Internet Protocol. Yes, Sherman? Bingo. Source and destination ports. That's correct. Those are the four obvious fields in a packet header. There's another one which is called time to live, which says, if this packet has been moving around for too long, just throw it away and start again. But we don't care about that right now because we're not actually worrying about the complex timing of the traffic. But that's correct. You could think of every packet as identified in four places. Source, destination, source port, destination port. And now you can imagine the beginning of how our artificially intelligent security software works. It will look for patterns in source and destination and source port and destination port. We'll start thinking about the traffic on the basis of those four measurements, like latitude and longitude and altitude. I mean, yeah, they're coordinates. And we can begin to think about what it means that packets are moving from this place to that place and going this way and that way. And how long is it taking and what are they moving through? But that's correct. You have the metrics correct. You want to go on from there?
No.
Mm-hmm. So, now as you notice, pretty soon, once we begin to define services, we're no longer just talking about how to move a packet. We're talking about how to understand an aggregation of packets, an HTML file that came back from a request to a web server, an RFC 1814 compliant email message that was sent to somebody by SMTP or received back to a browser or some other brain-dead mail tool through IMAPs. In each case, what we need is a construct which tells us about more than the packet. The packet got moved in an envelope from post office A to post office B, but the mail means something. It's a copy of Time Magazine or your copy of Spin or whatever it is. So we need then to understand that in this process of moving packets around, in addition to the Internet Protocol, which tells us just what the rules are for moving packets, we have rules about collections of packets, files, streams, bunches of data in whatever organization. And we have a transport control protocol, which explains how some unit larger than a packet, generally a file, is moved. How we know that the file is complete, how we know that it hasn't been corrupted, how we understand that we have received all the jigsaw puzzle pieces and we don't have to keep waiting for any more. All of those pieces are part of the set of rules we call TCP, and together we call it TCP/IP, which is the set of protocol rules which are the Internet. The rules which explain how all the computers relate to one another without regard to their internal composition or the way they represent data or anything else. There are layers on top of TCP/IP, and we're going to come to them because, well, there's Twitter, for example. But for the moment, what we're trying to do is to understand the anatomy. Before it starts working, what are the rules of the anatomy itself? Before the organism is doing anything, how is it made? This organism we call the net is made of the set of rules, TCP/IP, which define its anatomy. How the pipes and switches work together to create the phenomena of services with which human beings and other computers then interact. Questions? Objections. This is really important because everything is built on this. This is the real estate at the corner of the course. No, we've got it. Yeah?
So, who decided how the protocols?
Excellent question. Really, really good. I referred to RFC 1843. That sounded like a reference to a rule set, okay? So you're right. All of this, from your point of view, is made of rules. And somebody had to decide on those rules, and the correct question is who? And the answer is we. RFC, which is the preface to each of those rules followed by a number, stands for Request for Consensus. The answer to your question is that all of the rules that make the internet are the result of successful requests for consensus. We all made all these rules. And the RFCs remained in draft, round after round after round after round, until among the relevant decision makers, I'm coming there in a second, there was consensus. And an RFC exists as long as its consensus remains, after which it will be replaced by a new consensus, which will have a different number. And instead of being RFC 1813, it'll be RFC 2424, and the rules will have changed. Consensus. I might remind you that this is anarchism, okay? Power is generated by consensus and is destroyed by its withdrawal. Nuclear war created the anarchism of the net. I once upon a time, I was in Shenzhen, in the center of the digital China. And I was eating lunch with Chinese lawyers at a great, big, immense, strangely structured manufacturer. I'm eating lunch with lawyers. That means I'm eating lunch with women. Because as one of the executives of that company once said to me, in our company, boys are engineers and girls are lawyers and customer service agents. This will explain to you what will happen to the social role of lawyers when the rule of law is absent, right? If there is a society full of lawyers without the rule of law, then they are in fact customer service agents. So of course they should be girls, because in such a society there will also be patriarchy. I mean, it's China, right? So we're eating lunch, the Chinese lawyers and I, in a restaurant in Shenzhen. And one of the lawyers looks at me and she says, with genuine astonishment, it's such an exotic event. She looks at me and she says, so you are a communist. Yes, I say. I am the only communist in China. And then she says, in the inevitable next statement, she says, oh, and so you're a Jew. Yes, actually, that's right. Good of you to see the connection. So we got anarchism in the net. We made it there. We put it there, we operate it there, we have run the net that way, we have made all those rules for two human generations. But we should look a little more closely, because of course you're not going to believe me, it's not really anarchism, it's just pretending to be anarchism. It's the Internet Engineering Task Force. IETF manages the RFC process. Now we have got to the center of the conspiracy. And it's weird, because the IETF is a conspiracy, absolutely. I mean, you would expect the great big objects that control everything to send their engineers to the IETF and control the outcomes. The IETF has a weird rule. The weird rule is that the IETF's position is that every engineer working at the IETF has no company. The IETF pretends, whatever verb you want, the IETF behaves as though all engineers are citizens of Techland and they don't work anywhere and they have no companies. And that's the official dogma of this conversation. You don't believe that either, of course. It's got to be corrupt. And sort of it is and sort of it isn't, because if you think about it, what that really means is that the Internet Engineering Task Force was invented by John Rawls. Right? They have an artificial veil of ignorance, correct? And they make the rules about the internet based on consensus among people sitting behind. I mean, you got to admit, I mean, really, it's extremely liberal, right? It's almost as though it was invented at Harvard. Right. So, but, I mean, all this anarchy, I mean, it must be fake, right? I mean, all this, they're not really people without companies. And it's true. Sometimes they behave really like people with companies. I'll give you an example. I mean, right now, we don't have to worry about the service by which your transient endpoint is assigned an address. Each of these objects has an address right now. When you came in here and you associated with the wireless or you clipped the cable to the, well, cable? What? When you did whatever you did in order to allow people to spy on you, you were assigned an address. Right at the moment, I don't know which one each of you has and you don't want me to spend any time finding out. But let's say that one of you at the moment is 128.59.94.149. And you have that address until you leave this room and drop off the Wi-Fi, and then the next place you go, you'll get another dynamic address, so-called. And we assign those dynamic addresses via another protocol. We've been trying to improve this internet protocol of ours for many decades. This one, with these four numbers here, is called IPv4. We made a better one long ago, but we don't use it because infrastructure is sticky, and you use the old roads even after you've built the new ones. But each protocol version of IP has to have a little bit connected with it which knows how to dynamically assign an address. Because otherwise we can't move our computers around, and we need to move our computers around a lot. I mean, you do. I don't know why, but you do. So we need dynamic addressing, and each time we go, we have to make new rules. So back when we were making IPv6, the much improved program process we don't use, we had to define an automated address assignment system, the equivalent of the one we use in IPv4 called DHCP. You don't care about the acronyms, but we need a function. So IETF goes to work getting consensus on how to assign addresses in IPv6 networks. That's good, and there's a bunch of IETF engineers there, and they're all very good, and some of them work for Microsoft. But it doesn't matter that they work for Microsoft, because everybody at IETF is just an individual engineer making decisions on pure technical merit. And so they have a meeting in Washington, D.C., an ordinary working group meeting of the a dynamic address assignment working group, and they finalize the deal, and they make the rules for DHCP, for IPv6, and then they go to have lunch. And except the Microsoft guys don't go to have lunch. The Microsoft guys get in a taxi cab, and they go to the patent office in Arlington, Virginia, and they patent the thing that was just decided at the IETF meeting. So that now they own it. And then some asshole who teaches at Columbia Law School comes along and sends them a note and says, if you do that, I'm going to break your patent, and I'm going to lay the dismembered pieces of your patent out in public, and I'm going to call the newspapers to come and take pictures of your dismembered pieces of your stinking patent, and how dare you? And so 3 months later, they decide to make a very generous dedication of their new patent to the world, and everything is fine again. So, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's true that every once in a while, if you want to have working anarchism, you have to put a bomb in the street where the admiral that works for Franco is going to roll over it so that you can blow him all the way up to the roofs of the surrounding buildings, right? We're lawyers. We do stuff like that. But that doesn't mean that anarchism has stopped working just because there is a lawyer somewhere. Of course, the lawyer should have a big sense of irony. That's why we practice the way we practice. Now we're great friends with Microsoft because they're on our side again for reasons that we'll look at when we get there. But that moment, that was a little tense. It was. Not a quite as tense. Never mind. I'm not gonna, but you get the point. Okay, yes. It's request for consensus, yes. Anarchism, yes. The veil of ignorance, Rawlsian theories of justice, yes. And every once in a while you need a lawyer with a baseball bat who's prepared to blow somebody's, you know, weekend over it and put them in intensive care or else. But anarchism is still, you know, it's a lovely thing, right? It's the problem of the Spanish Civil War. I mean, you know, anarchists are lovely people until you push them into a corner and then they're us. Was that responsive to your question about who makes these rules?
Yeah.
Good. We needed to address it, so I'm glad it worked. More questions like this? Or not like this? Okay, well then let's make the internet more complicated. If you think about it then, this anatomy has as its purpose the production of services. Its purpose is to make it possible for things to get requested and other things to answer. And all the rules and all the structures underneath and all the relations of pipes and switches are designed to facilitate some system for exchange of services. But we don't know anything yet about the pricing or control of those services. Because all the rules we made were made by consensus on the basis of equality and peerage. All the rules we made were on the basis of the idea that every computer is equal, and that anybody can send a request to any port on any computer and either get satisfied or declined in some polite and appropriate way. That the rules will function without any particular party being in charge of any particular set of services. And given that we all have computers, and we do, and that we can all have those computers offer any services on any port that we want, and we can, we have at least the possibility that any request can be satisfied by anybody who wants to. Now we begin to come to the politics that matter to me. I'm talking about the 16-year-old me in 1975, when we are making these things. The 16-year-old me, like the 64-year-old me standing here today, wants every brain on earth to be able to learn anything it wants, wherever it is, at any time, without regard to the ability to pay or the whims of government. That's what the 16-year-old wants. From his point of view, that's simply an application of existing architecture. Any brain on earth can learn whatever it wants, wherever it is, without regard to ability to pay or the whims of government, because if it can frame a question and deliver it to the correct port, it will get answered. Every book, every piece of music, every piece of culture, everything capable of being digitized, of which it is true that there were some things not capable of being digitized in 1975, but trust me, they are now. Everything, which we could share over a network of non-hierarchical architecture, committed to the principle of management by consensus, and dedicated to the proposition that from each according to inclination and ability, and to each according to need, we had that, we still have that, it still embodies in a direct and theoretically consistent fashion that idea. We built it to kill Russians with. But it works. Questions? There are a lot of law schools in the world. Lots and lots and lots and lots of them. In no other law school in the world did anybody else just say those things to people like you. Already you are carrying exotic and potentially forbidden knowledge. I do not need to explain to you that there is at least one country containing at least 1.4 billion people in which you are not supposed to know these things. Because their consequences are political. Right? Questions? You mean, did the Slork in Myanmar ever say that they would impose the death penalty for possession of unauthorized modems?
Sure.
Yes, they did that. That's true. Would it be a kind of a bad experiment to try and put some privacy services inside the net in, say, Beijing? Yes, it would. In 1817, I had two comrades in Beijing, members of the Beijing Linux Users Group, the BLUG, a very important underground institution. Two members of the BLUG were working on privacy proxy software, kind of like some software I'm going to give you in a couple of weeks. And they vanished. And a couple months later, one of our comrades there said to me, "We will never, ever even find their ashes." So, yes, was that responsive? It's exotic, potentially forbidden knowledge. And I just taught it to you, and you thought, Jesus, this is a snooze. Why doesn't he talk about something important? That's the problem of the 21st century we live in.
So the use of that technology is traceable?
Ah, thank you, Brent. Well, you see, part of the problem is that, as Charlotte pointed out to you, every packet says where it came from. That's part of what happened, right? When we made the internet protocol, we didn't provide for anonymity. We didn't provide for absence of traceability. Every packet says on it where it came from and where it's going to. Because we're making a network which is supposed to work not about protecting privacy, it's supposed to keep the Russians from being able to destroy the planet all by themselves without being destroyed back. Privacy, anonymity, that traceability? You see, it's not part of the architecture. The architecture fights us. That doesn't mean we can't do things by layering on top of the architecture. But you know, concrete is a pain in the ass. Cement is expensive and heavy to manufacture, and it takes a lot of energy, and it makes a lot of mess. And mixing concrete is really tricky, and if you do it wrong, then the concrete falls apart, and the mafia is always busy making concrete. Wouldn't it be nice if we could just have a thing that was better than concrete, because it didn't, you could just lift it and put it in place. Why don't we just do to concrete what we did to bread when we made Wonder Bread? Just blow a lot of air in it. Now, as you may be aware, if you've been reading news from the United so-called Kingdom in the last week, we did that, and then we put all that stuff in the roofs of all the schools, and then 30 years later it starts falling down, and suddenly we have to spend a ton of money. You see, that's kind of the anonymity problem. We built a network out of aerated concrete, and after a while we needed to deal with privacy, and the concrete was already falling apart. And suddenly we have a bunch of really expensive people like Zuckerberg and Dorsey and Musk and the king of the undead now dead, and they all like the fact that the network doesn't provide for any anonymity, because they're building the parasite. The parasite wants to know who you are. It will be watching you. And the network will, by its architecture, have been making that inevitable, or at least possible. And if we wanted to do something about that, we had to do it either when we made it or afterwards, which is why I need a freedom box for you. Because we've got to untangle all that stuff. or the best we can, we have to try and untangle it. So we have to add layers of technology on top of the architecture to fight the architecture. It's all very ironic. Was that helpful? Well, I wouldn't use Tor if I was in China, because they'll come for me. And I might, if I want to build a freedom box, I might have to do some little tricky business to try and figure out how to make all that work. And I might actually think to myself, this stuff really needs to be good or my comrades will get killed. Which maybe is part of why making a freedom box is not quite as easy as it looks, because... But then we need a bunch of cheap hardware. And now we are very lucky because the Chinese Communist Party needs all that cheap hardware to be produced in the Pearl River Delta. And so it is busy cranking out freedom boxes for us all the time. Just don't put the software in it. More irony. Some of the work we need may be done by our enemies. If I don't want to have a $1,200 object manufactured by the king of the undead, now dead, to enslave me, if I want a laptop that is just as good and way more capable of not shitting on me, and if I want it to cost one-tenth as much, I can do that. And I'll probably wind up with a little thing that used to be a Chromebook, manufactured by manufacturers around the world who turn out wonderful cheap laptops that don't need all the crap in them that a Windows computer would require, because Google helped them to design it and subsidized it and helped Samsung and Acer and Asus to make them. And they're really great, and we can throw all the crap off there, including all the Google crap, and run it with true free software because Google engineered to play fair about it. And has relentlessly done so. And that means, again, as I say, that our adversaries are often working for us. We just need to have that way of ironically manipulating technology in which things that are supposed to work X way mysteriously turn out, when you add a little ingenuity and elbow grease and some wizardry, they work Y way instead, which might even be the opposite of X way. That activity, taking technology and turning it a little sideways so that it suddenly performs a thing that it wasn't meant to do, but you can make it do, there's a word for that. It grew out of MIT culture. We called it hacking. The people who didn't like it tried to turn that into a word of criminality. We became bad people. We're hackers. Yeah, that's correct. You're a communist, aren't you? Yes, I'm the only communist in China. You're an anarchist, aren't you? Yes, I am an anarchist. You're a hacker. Yes, that's right. Now we have got to the part of my identity of which I am really, really proud. That other stuff is purely derivative, right? When I wanted the Communist Manifesto, I didn't have to make it. I stole it. When I wanted anarchism triumphant, free software and the death of copyright, all I had to do was rip off anarchism. But when we're hacking, we're making it ourselves. We're not derivative of anything. Just the technology we ironically redirected. So what will turn out to be true, as you will see, is that the consequence of the effort to put anonymity and untraceability and liberty back into the net for us requires hacking. We have to construct all the things that would be necessary in order to take all of that and turn it into something that will behave the way we want, even though it was built to do something else. Which is sort of like basing all of free culture and the ability of human beings to learn whatever they want on a device made to make nuclear war easier.